session number 11963, Wheel 4.
Captain Henderson, Reel 4. Before we go on, I wanted to correct an impression, I think, given by a mishearing about the 26th of April. You said that you weren't under artillery fire, but I think you misheard me and thought that I said that I was asking you about British artillery fire.
Yeah, that's it.
But I understand there was quite considerable German shell fire, particularly
definitely.
Shrapnel.
Oh, yes, it was the German shell fire that did a lot of the damage. And I would like to correct that immediately. It has been a careless no, if I said so. And I don't know how it happened, because one of the things that's always been in my mind was the absence of British gunfire at St. Julian.
But you said that there was an absence of British gunfire, but there was plenty of German gunfire.
Plenty of German gunfire.
Was it mainly shrapnel or was it high explosive?
Both. The shrapnel and high explosive.
And what do you think caused the most casualties, the artillery or the small arms?
Oh, I think the small arms were responsible for most of the casualties.
But there was plenty of shell fire.
Oh, yes.
What did you find shell fire frightening that first time? I mean,
yes, one has to admit it. It was the first time we'd been into action, and we were sampling these things for the first time, and to find that shells were coming, and you could hear them coming, of course, it was frightening. And we all agreed later on that the shell fire was very destructive.
Right. Now, we were talking about the conditions in the Hooge sector.
Oh, yes.
Wood. And we dealt with sort of the rations you got.
Yes.
What about the sanitary arrangements, basically? Were you able to wash and keep clean, shave?
Oh, no, sir. No, not by any means. Hooge Wood was a position in the line where you couldn't take liberties very much. Things were so close to the Germans that if you managed to get your early morning cup of tea made, it was something to be proud of, because they were continually firing at the top of the trenches.
You weren't expected to wash or shave while you were there?
Oh, no, I don't think anybody paid any particular attention as long as we kept alive.
And what about the latrines? What latrine arrangements were made there?
Well, of course, the arrangements when you went into the line was you had to dig your own latrines, which were, if possible, convenient along a narrow strip of soil was excavated, thrown to one side, thrown up at the back. And there was a bar or a tree trunk or whatever we could muster put along in the centre. And that's all you had. It was one of the things that caused a lot of unhappiness amongst people. Conditions weren't good. If the weather was bad, it was terrible. Made worse by the weather. It was one of the things that we never seemed to get on top. They did appoint sanitary men later on in the war. Each battalion had 3 or 4 sanitary men whose particular job was to dig decent or somewhat more usable latrines, you know. But that was a nasty aspect of trench warfare. But we were so far down the scale of human behaviour that in the end it didn't matter.
Did the army make any effort to provide paper or anything like that, or did you have to fend for yourself?
Oh, no, you had to provide that to yourself, you know. In the trenches, all your pockets contained things which you wanted, and you wanted to save because you used them. you soon learn to fill your pockets up with things that you might want.
What about the disposal of waste from the trenches, things like tin cans, you know, the rubbish of trench life?
Well, that was simply put into the trenches, and it was covered up when the latrine was covered up. That's the easy way. There was no means of getting the scrap, empty bully beef tins and this sort of thing. There was no means of getting them out of the line. There was no containers to hand to the ration people in the evening. Nothing like that. And it all went into the latrines in the end.
So the cans weren't just thrown about, they were buried in the latrine when
That's right. And they had to dig somewhere else after that. Of course, all these things had to be out of sight of the Germans and things like that. And sometimes they weren't very near. They were dug in the first place that was considered to be good.
Did you, while you were in the Hooge area, did you have problems with lice? I mean, did that problem arise early?
Oh, yes, yes. Now, that's a point. I've taken my trousers off in Hooge once, I think, and when we've left the trenches. And if you turned your trousers inside out and lifted up the seams, you found a white mass going right down. And they were lice. And we had to contend with these things, you see, all the time we were in the line.
And how long was it before you got them? I mean...
Oh, I should say, at about the time of Hooge, we went over in April, and we were in Hooge by the September, August, September, and the lice were just beginning to get kingdoms, forming kingdoms for themselves, you know.
How did you try and get rid of them?
Oh, well... The lads had the idea of turning the trousers inside out, lifting up the seams and running a match up, if you were careful enough not to singe the material. But, of course, the ideal way of dealing with them was to run a hot iron up when you got out of the line. But we had lice the whole of the time we were in that trenches.
Were they a great irritation to you? Did they annoy you?
Oh, yes, yes. Not so much all the time, but there were times when you had to decide that you've got to scratch yourself with the lice. And it wasn't very nice, of course. I'd not been used with anything like that. And it was degrading.
Did the scratching lead to any of the skin diseases, the lice and scratching?
I wouldn't like to say that. I should imagine if other people were like myself, they had a pretty red skin on their backside sometimes, or their legs and things like that. But I used to come home on leave with a chap whose father and mother...
I'll come back to the leave, because I'll deal with all that together. So lice were a nuisance. Were there many rats in the Hooge sector?
No. That's one thing. I don't think we were ever troubled with rats in the Hooge sector. No, I can't remember any there.
Now, one of the things you've mentioned were a nuisance were the proximity of dead bodies, either in no man's land or shallowly buried. Was that a real problem to you there?
Oh, very serious, very serious. Not only that, but I have to say this, and I hope some of the relatives of these people don't take exception to it, that things were so bad at Hooge that when you had men to bury, you sometimes found yourself digging up previous graves. And I did it. And by Jove, it came as a huge shock to me to find that I was upcasting corpses which had been buried by some previous occupation of the... But on the Ypres salient, anything could happen because actions were fought in every square inch of the Ypres salient, I think, from the time that Ypres was bombarded by the Germans.
So there were bodies everywhere.
Bodies everywhere. And myself once, I spent the whole of one night taking discs from dead bodies and gathering them up before the men were buried. That will give you some idea.
Was there a problem with, it's a horrible subject, but smell from the bodies while you were in a place like Hooge?
It only happened if these bodies were in a place where the Germans shelled afterwards. You know, if there'd been, say 20 or so people buried in a grave, and after, say, 3 or 4 months, there was a bombardment by the Germans, and they threw everything up. Well, it was a massacre, smell and everything else. You had to do the best you could.
What was the procedure for dealing with? I mean, I know you dealt with bodies in several ways. Was the procedure from when someone was killed to what did they do before they buried them, and how was the grave marked? If you could take us through the procedure as you saw it, because I know you took part.
As a matter of fact, yes, it's a case of a chap was killed. You either could get rid of him during the day or you couldn't.
Now, what was getting rid of? That would be passing them back, do you mean?
Passing them back, yes.
Who would carry them back?
Oh, the stretcher bearers. We had stretcher bearers, you know, and they carried them to a point where they dealt with them. Anything that was needed to be done, the stretcher bearers did it. And there were even burial parties behind the line, of course, whose job it was specifically to bury people. One just chose a spot, I should imagine. I do know that once when I saw a lad killed and I saw him buried, I went back to the stretcher bearers, saw him buried, and wrote to his two sisters that Bill had been killed and I had seen him buried. I knew where the grave was. And when the war was finished, I hoped to bring them across to see Bill's grave. But unfortunately, in the meantime, about a few months afterwards, the Germans laid down a barrage, which included the place where he was buried, and blew the ground and him and everything else to smithereens. And many was the excuse I had to tell those poor two girls that I couldn't carry out my suggestion of bringing them over to France because I couldn't tell them where Bill was buried. And it plagued me for years, but in the end, what can you do?
So that was if they got back to the stretcher bearers, they were buried and the grave was marked.
That's right, yes.
With a cross. And this is what you mentioned you were writing.
Oh, yes, my brushes carried out work on, dozens of
And what
crosses.
Would you write?
Just wood crosses, you know.
What were they made of, the crosses? I mean, where would they get the
wood from? Wood. They were what you call homemade in the trenches. I never saw pre-made crosses. It was only when the War Graves Commission was established.
So what would you write on them? What details would you put normally?
Oh, you had to make it as brief as possible. Lance Corporal was his name, that's all.
Would you put his army number on?
Would you?
Put his army number on?
No, I don't think. No, I can honestly say I don't think I ever put an army number. Which was his name.
There were two identity discs, weren't there? Was one buried with the body and the other one...
That's right, collected and put into records.
But one was left on the body?
That's right, yes.
Now, that was if the stretcher bearers took them back.
Yes.
What happens if the stretcher bearers couldn't take them back? How would you deal with it in the line?
The disc would be taken off. There's no doubt about that in the line. I once had a lad killed with me. He was a local lad in Shields, yeah. And it was about 10 o'clock in the morning when he was shot. and I couldn't do anything with him. You couldn't get him out or anything like that. And he had to lie there all day with a sheet over him, of course. I didn't take his disc off because I knew the stretcher bearers would come up in the dark, after dark, you see, and take him away, which they did. I've also seen a chap put on an ambulance and bid goodbye to him. He was only wounded. He was never heard tell of again.
So you didn't actually, you would always get them back from the stretcher bearers somehow. They weren't buried in the line ever.
Oh, no. No.
You'd always get them out just when you could.
When we could, yes, that's right. Yeah.
Now, what was the... So, one disc was collected and one was left with the body.
Yes.
What would happen to the one that was collected? What was the procedure then? So, someone had been killed.
You'd they were taken charge of by... with the stretcher bearers who handed them to the battalion sergeant major. And he was responsible to the orderly room for giving casualties and particulars and this sort of thing.
So that would get the official record of what had happened.
That's the official record, yes.
And so that would be recorded as killed, not missing in action. That would be killed in action.
Killed in action, yes. Died of wounds and this sort of thing.
And it was the ones no one where the tags didn't come back that would get the missing in action.
That's right, missing in action, yes.
So what was the next stage? Who would write back home? Would the officer write, or would it? You said you did some writing. What was the normal thing about writing back?
Well, the normal thing was that a platoon officer would do it, but that was a very hard job when you're under fire. So. Every battalion had a battalion postman, corporal or a sergeant, with the quartermaster sergeants all behind the line, you see. They never went into the line. And he took upon himself the job of writing it to relatives.
And that's what you did when you were the battalion postman?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
But that was later, that wasn't at Hoosier.
Later on, yes.
Right. What would they write in the letters? I mean, what sort of thing would you say? Would you tell the truth, or would you just say...
Oh, yes. Or tell the truth. I think it was most marked that they wanted to tell... be honest with these people as to what had happened. We all decided that it was no use camouflaging. They were soldiers in battle, and they're killed or wounded or missing.
So you would say what had actually happened rather than saying he died a glorious, you know, some
oh
sort of...
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, you have to be honest. We had a little faux-pas in the battalion about meals once when the troops complained that they hadn't had this and hadn't had that, and it was found... in the end, that the battalion postman had them all under his bed sleeping.
And why had he done that?
Oh, I should imagine because he was mad.
What was the weather like while you were at Hooge, generally?
Bad. Wet was the main factor. It was April, May. It was May and June that we were at Hooge, you know, and despite the nearness of the trenches, there were other things that were irritating as far as weather went and this sort of thing. We were only new from England in April, which was the first time they'd been in action, and things weren't very happy in Hooge.
So it was the wet rather than the cold.
Wet rather than the cold, yes. I think the lads could keep themselves more warm than dry. But we had very little at that time by way of, coats and this sort of thing. We had waterproof sheets, which were not too good. You could lie on them, of course, but when you woke up, you had more water than you would have had otherwise.
Did the trenches get wet at the bottom?
Oh, yes, yes. And the answer to that was duck boards, of course.
You had duck boards at Hooge?
Duck boards, yes. There were some places where duck boards weren't necessary. But even then, duck boards made very difficult... what shall I say? They were always tipping up or something like that, you know. There weren't things that you welcomed with open arms. You had to be careful when you were using them.
Did you find it difficult to get dry once your feet had got wet?
Oh, yes, that was a problem. That was a problem. The only thing that you depended upon was... The brigade was in action, of course, and certain battalions took the front line, and then behind them was in reserve, etc. They went back. And getting out of the line, you either went out completely for a rest, or you went from the main front line trenches to the reserve trenches, this sort of thing. And then there was a little chance that you might find means of getting dry.
Were there any problems with trench feet from having your feet wet
for the day? A lot of people suffered from their feet. Apparently, I found out when I was in France that a lot of people suffered from feet that easily damaged themselves. And it was most marked. Some lads were always complaining about their feet. Whereas from other people, you never heard them mentioned.
Did you have any trouble with your feet?
No, I can't say that I ever had any trouble at all.
Did they have issues of whale oil that early, in 15? Did they have an issue of whale oil during 1915 at Hooge, or had that not come in yet?
No, they hadn't come. No, they weren't there yet.
What about other diseases of trench life? Was there much trouble with trench fever?
No.
Or dysentery?
No, I can't say that those things ever troubled us. I think I have a pretty good idea.
So what was your health like at Hooge?
Oh, I was quite fit. I was only very young, of course. I was underage. Seemed to go through it well. I was glad when we got out, mind. By Jove.
So what was the daily routine like at Hooge? Say we start... Did you have a stand to in the morning?
Oh, yes, stand to and a drink of rum.
What was the procedure then at stand to? What did you do?
Well, everybody stood to in the trenches, and you hadn't any particular appointed post. Of course, having gone into the line, you're allocated a bay, that four of you could look after, five of you could look after, and this sort of thing. And the stand to was just a chin wag. And it was in order for an hour, about an hour, a stand to.
Would you all look over the top, or just the sentries?
Well, we had spy glasses, of course. We had... instruments where we could see over the top of the trenches.
Periscopes.
We listened, of course. We listened for quite a lot at Hooge because you could almost hear what they were doing in their trenches.
So, did you have the rum issue while you were standing to, or before or after?
At the beginning of stand to, the orderly corporal used to come around with a little glass, you know, you could hardly see it contained anything, within a bottle of rum, and he used to dish it out, and he used to drink it right off.
And what would happen after stand two, then?
After stand two, it would be stand down, and you'd go back. If you went on sentry duty, by that I mean each bay in the trenches were looked after during the day by a relay of people who were in the trenches, and 2 hours on and 2 hours off and this sort of thing.
And what would the sentry do? When you were sentry, what would you do?
Oh, well, we had to keep a lookout. That was the most important thing.
And would you use the periscope rather than look over yourself?
We always had the glass, of course, to see over the top. But on the whole, you could look over the top and they were in the same predicament as you were, you know. And I found at Hooge that there was very little you could fire at. They, like us, kept well below the trenches.
But I thought you said the sentries looked over the trenches.
The what?
You just said the sentries were looking over the trenches.
Oh, well, by that I mean they kept a lookout. They weren't continually gazing over the trench top. It was a lookout, say, every 5 minutes or something like that.
So you just have a quick
That's
peep.
Right, a quick look, yes. Nothing had changed.
So that was if you were on sentry, and that was 2 hours on, 2 hours off.
2 hours off.
What, when you were off, where, you just sit in the bay, would you?
Oh, yes. All you could do was to sit in the trenches, that's right, and hope for the next meal coming along, or a hot cup of coffee, or something like that.
And what were you doing, if you weren't on sentry duty, what would you be doing during the day then?
Well, we just sat and talked. A lot of the boys tried to make things, attempted to darn socks if they're inclined to do that. But on the whole, the time passed all right. And I don't think I was ever in need of something to do when I was in Hooge Wood.
What sort of things would they talk about? Would they talk about the war, or would they talk about home, or what sort of topics?
Well, I think by the time we got to Hooge, we'd been there since April. You know, football was still a topic, and the cinema and this sort of thing. Very seldom they mentioned their relatives, I noticed. That was one point that I took. They never discussed their sweethearts or anything like that.
Did they ever discuss the war?
No, strange to say, they did not discuss it at all. It seemed to be inside their province there, where they were standing, but outside their province when their mind went further afield.